succession number 27344, wheel 25.
McCandless, wheel 25.
It's quite extraordinary, you know, but at the end of the Suez business, we virtually stopped flying except for, I don't know, let me have a look. Oh, yeah, we kept doing formation aerobatics. And then we flew ashore to Halfar in Malta. And, do you know, I can't remember how we got back from Halfar. I presume we were flown by somebody, but we didn't bring our own aircraft back. They were left at Halfar. And somebody else flew them from Halfar back to Britain. But I just cannot remember. I must have been drunk all the time. I just don't remember how we got back. But anyway.
You said before the operation the squadron had been disbanding.
Is yes.
That still the plan after the Suez?
Yes, yes, we disbanded immediately we got back. But one thing which was a bit disappointing for me, when we were disbanding the first time, I had an appointment to go to Culham, which is now the Atomic Research Establishment in Oxfordshire. At that time, there was one of the RNVR air squadrons operating from Culham, and I was going to go to be the RN officer in charge of the squadron. And I was really looking forward to it because I had been RNVR myself, and I knew a lot of them anyway, and I was really looking forward. And I said Culham, that's wrong, it was RAF Benson they were at the time, quite close at hand. Anyway, I went down to Benson and sort of got to know some of them again and started to look for somewhere to live in the immediate vicinity. And I'd picked out a bungalow, actually, and started to talk about what we were going to do about this, letting this bungalow. And then, damn me, if Suez didn't crop up and the whole thing fell flat in its face. And by the time we came back, somebody else had filled in the job and I was going to have to go elsewhere. I'm trying to think where I did go. Oh, I went to the Admiralty. No, I didn't. I went to RAF Valley, to the training establishment. I became naval training officer. Yeah. I became naval training officer at RAF Valley. Now, that was a bit of a sinecure, because the naval pilots under training were mainly involved with their training in ground school and flying. They'd do ground school in the morning, fly in the afternoon, or the other way around. And if there was no flying because of bad weather, sometimes I would have to lay on some sort of a program for them. But it was always short notice, and it was always entertainment of some kind, whether it was a game of football or whatever. I didn't have very much to do with their actual training. Their naval training as such had all been completed before, and their RAF flying training was not my concern. So you can see it was a bit of a sinecure. And there were three of us there on this sinecure: the senior naval officer, who was a commander, myself as a lieutenant commander, and the paymaster officer. And he was just an administration officer, making sure that the naval stores was all properly catered for and payments were made correctly to the students and that sort of thing. But one thing I did have to do there, which amused me intensely, was I had to arrange the Wings Parade. And this was a matter of getting a senior naval officer to come and present the wings to the students who were passing out, and to arrange the whole parade, how they marched on, you know, and to lay out the seats for the guests, And then I had to give them a 5 or 10 minute talk to the guests, telling mums and dads what their sons had been doing and how well they'd been doing it. And this could either be in one of the hangars if the weather was bad, or out in the open if the weather was good. And it so happened on the occasion that I'm thinking of that the weather was good. And this is an RAF valley on the western coast of Anglesey. Really a very, very pleasant place to be, except for the Welsh. And why I say that is I found them really very bad-mannered, because if we went into a shop in Holyhead and there were some Welsh people speaking to the shopkeeper, as soon as we went in, they stopped speaking English and started speaking Welsh. Now, I think that was bloody bad manners. In other places in the world that I've been to, if they're speaking their own language when we get in, they stop and start to speak English. And I thought that was a much better way to go on. But there you are, it's just one of those things. Anyway, I enjoyed RAF Valley. And I'd got this parade laid on, and there were a couple of loudspeakers out behind the audience. And I was on a small dais down at the front. And the men were going to parade in the middle. And I started to talk to the parents. And as I started to speak, suddenly I could hear someone with a Scots voice interrupting me. And I thought, bloody hell, what's going on here? So I stopped a little bit, and there's no interruption. So then I carried on, and then it came again. And it dawned on me, this was my voice coming back from these loudspeakers some distance away. It's very off-putting, very off-putting. Anyway, I explained to the parents what was going on, and young men marched on and were presented with their wings by an admiral I'd managed to get there, and marched off again, and the band played the right music at the right time, so all went well. But I compared this in my own mind with the way we had been presented with our wings when I qualified in Canada. And the way we were presented with the wings, there was a notice put on the board, "The following may wear the flying badge." And that was it. But it was a sinecure of a job, really. And I used to fly the de Havilland Domini. I don't know if you know it. Have you heard of it? It's a biplane with very narrow wings and two engines, carries 7 passengers. And we used to use this as a sort of taxi between RAF Valley and Brodie or wherever else we wanted to go or felt like going very nearly. So I used to use this to take luggage from RAF Valley to Lossiemouth when the pilots were going there. And if they were going somewhere else, I'd take their luggage somewhere else. But this particular time, there was quite a number going to Lossiemouth. And I got all the baggage into the back of the aircraft, and it was sort of down the aisles and in the seats. And I was flying the aircraft on my own. So anyway, I taxied out and got to the end of the runway and started belting down the runway. And at the point where I would normally sort of let the tail rise gently, I couldn't get the tail off the ground. I had far too much weight in the back of the aircraft. I thought, oh, God. So I tried again, see if I could get the tail off the ground. And in fact, it did rise all right. So, oh, well, I'm still in charge, that's all right. Anyway, I got airborne and set off towards Lossiemouth. And I don't know if I've talked about the trims on the aircraft, but I think I have. The trim is a small control you can use to help you move the main flying controls. And the elevator trim is a small tab which just moves the elevators to take the weight off the stick. So I trimmed fully forward, and I was still pushing on the stick to keep the aircraft line straight and level. What a stupid thing to do. Anyway, I flew off from Anglesey across the Solway Firth and across the south of Scotland, flying over the mountains around about Perth and going on towards Lossie. I thought, you bloody idiot. Anyway, we got to Lossiemouth and managed to land safely. And the ratings came into the aircraft to take the luggage out. They looked around and saw this scattered all over the back of the aircraft, and they must have wondered. They really must have wondered. But we used to do this telosimide quite regularly. And I remember one occasion flying in the Domini. Obviously, when you're flying along and the wind is from the side, you steer a course into wind slightly to allow for the amount of drift as you go along. And I was flying up to Lossiemouth, and there was a westerly gale, and it really was strong. And I had to fly 40 degrees off course to allow for the amount of drift with a strong wind, because the wind was nearly as strong as the speed of the aircraft. It's a very, very slow machine. And I was crabbing along like this to get to Lossiemouth, and again got there safely, but I was astonished at the amount of drift I had to allow for to get there. Another time flying in the Domini along over the Grampians, I found an eagle alongside me at about 6,000 feet. And I thought, how bloody marvellous. And of course the eagle was nearly as fast as I was. But another occasion, flying the Domini at Lossiemouth, it had been snowing, and quite a lot of snow actually, and the snow ploughs had cleared the snow off the runway and left it in heaps either side of the runway. And there wasn't very much flying going on because it was mainly students at Lossiemouth at that time. And I went up and asked to land, and they said okay. And when I went in to land, the snow was higher than the lower main plane. And it was quite an interesting experience. I hadn't had that before. But with two engines, it was easy enough to control the aircraft on the snow. It was a very, very comfortable old aircraft to fly. It really was. I used to use it when I was at Lossiemouth on another occasion. We used to use the Domini to go and feed the cattle and sheep in the hills during the snow. If the farmers rang up and said they needed help, they would supply a load of hay to the airfield, and we would take the bales of hay out and drop them in the areas where they were required. And of course, dropping them in the right area was not always easy to find, because map reading when there's snow on the ground is a very tricky problem. You've got to use rivers and lakes and stuff like that as your pinpoints, and it's not always quite so easy. But anyway, RAF Valley again was a sinecure, which was pleasant enough, but I didn't enjoy it because I liked a more positive form of flying. Anyway, after RAF Valley, I was sent off to Lossiemouth to instruct again, I think. Is that right?
Would that be with 738 Squadron?
Yes. And that I enjoyed thoroughly, because I went as CO of 738 at that time. And that was a great job. We were flying both Seahawks and Sea Venoms at the time. And then some bright spark in the Board of Admiralty decided that the Seahawks would do their flying training at RAF Brodie in Wales, and we would carry on with the fighter training only in Venoms at Lossiemouth. So this was a complete change of direction as far as I was concerned, because I was no night fighter, and in fact I wasn't a particularly good air fighter at all. Ground attack was my particular forte. So anyway, we finished up in the squadron with only Venoms, and I wasn't very keen on them.
Can you tell me about the characteristics of the Venom as opposed to the Seahawk?
Well, it was a two-seater aircraft with an observer, and it had permanent drop tanks out on the end of the wing. And because when these are full of fuel, the rate of roll of the aircraft was really quite slow. It was designed, I understand, to be used as a night fighter, so obviously it wasn't intended to be doing violent manoeuvres and dogfighting and that sort of thing. The observer was going to pick up the opposition on the radar and direct the pilot onto them. And all he was required to do was to get line astern of the target and fire whatever weapon he was carrying. And, of course, they were training at that time with the first of the guided missiles, which were infrared guided with the exhaust of the target aircraft. So I wasn't terribly enthusiastic about instructing the pilots. It was the Venoms only. And one thing about the Venom which I didn't enjoy was if you were doing a steep turn at high altitude, you could quite easily find that the engine stopped. And this was a characteristic which all the Venom pilots knew about. But if it happened in cloud, it was a bit bloody frightening. So it happened to me once, and I really wasn't very keen on it. But the engine restarted all right. He just used the normal restarting procedure. And off we went and carried out the rest of the exercise. But it was one of the things about it that I didn't like. It was, I felt, clumsy compared with the Seahawk. And certainly it didn't have the power and agility of the Sea Fury. So I just wasn't terribly keen on it. And I wasn't terribly keen on the instructing job I was doing.
Why was that?
Well, it was training night fighter pilots to be fighter pilots. And as I say, it wasn't my forte particularly. But it was interesting, at the end of one of the courses, I had written my report on the course, and that includes details of all the hours that they had flown and whether they completed the exercises that they were supposed to complete and all that sort of thing. And I had written in my report that they hadn't completed the night flying. And not very long after that, I got a telephone call from one of the officers on the Admiral's staff saying, why had they not completed the night flying? I said, well, for goodness sake, in the middle of summer up here, there isn't enough night. Because when you take off and fly at 20,000 feet in the middle of the summer at Lossiemouth, it's broad daylight. I said, the fact they're flying after midnight doesn't make it night flying. And he was huffing and puffing on the other end of the line. He was bloody cross with me about this. I said, I don't care if people before me have been telling lies on every course that's gone through. There isn't enough night to do night flying. So I wasn't the least bit popular with the staff on that occasion. And I wasn't very popular with the CEOs of the 738 Squadron after that, because they were all required in the summer to take enough of the squadron from Lossiemouth to Brodie to carry out the night flying programme at Brodie. So that was a diversion that the other CEOs were not the least bit happy about. But it seemed to me to be such an obvious thing that they hadn't even thought about. But there you are, that's the sort of thing that happens. I suppose it's not terribly obvious, but sounds to people similar. Who fly from Lossiemouth, it's daylight.
Sounds similar to the monsoon story you
Oh yes, absolutely. But I wasn't all that keen on the Sea Venom. As I say, it was a two-seater aircraft, and we used to take people up to fly just to show them what it was like. Perhaps take them up on an air gunnery exercise where you were firing at a towed target and let them see the sort of thing they should be doing, but they couldn't do it because it was the observer's cockpit and there wasn't a flying control there. But there you are. It was not a happy part of my flying experience.
You mentioned the vice it had of sometimes the engine failing at high altitude.
Yeah.
Were there any other vices it had that you might have noticed?
Not really. I never deck landed it, so I couldn't tell you if there were any deck landing vices. But those who did deck land it seemed to be quite happy with it.
And had there been any changes in, obviously, the fighter tactics that you were training? the pilots to do?
Well, see, the thing is that I had been used to using forward-firing guns in the training that I had done in fighter work. And the Vixen was designed to fire off guided missiles. So it was a different form of fighter work, and I wasn't trained in it, and I wasn't competent to teach them. So it wasn't good. It really wasn't good.
With the guided missiles, what's different about that than from forward?
Well, you fire it from further away in the first place. What you've got to do is the radar picks up the target and you home in on it, and until the sight in the aircraft locks on, that's the cry, locked on, and once it's locked on to the exhaust of the target, it means that the infrared head of the guided missile is going to be capable of reading it. So you can fire the guided missile and it then starts to pick up the heat from the target aircraft and should be able to hit it. But of course, if the target aircraft sees you coming up, it has one or two ways in which you can deal with the problem. Either he can close his throttle, which there's no heat, so the weapon hasn't anything to steer on, or he can fire off little fireballs at regular intervals. And if he fires them out to the side, the infrared heater starts seeking in the wrong direction. And doing it that way, they can make the infrared weapon miss the target. So there are quite a few ways of avoiding it. But of course, I suppose nowadays, and I don't know enough about it, the missiles are probably guided by radar or laser or one of the many developments that I know absolutely nothing about. But I wasn't competent to teach what I was supposed to be teaching. That's what annoyed me.
With the guided missiles, was it then much more hit and miss than people would assume, maybe, that you just point it and it goes for the...
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing which a lot of people don't recognise is that the guided missiles in those days were guided by correcting their mistakes, if you see what I mean. If the weapon went off target, then it would start to correct. And it would go off target and start to correct. And in effect, what the guided missiles were doing was coming in behind the target aircraft in a spiral. And at the longest range, the spiral was quite wide. And then the spiral got smaller and smaller as it got close to the target until it pinpointed on it. So another tactic, low level, was to fly very low level. And during the spiral, the weapon would hit the ground. So there are a lot of ways that the target could get away from it. But again, you see, I just didn't feel competent and wasn't happy. I could teach them how to fly the aircraft and do a lot of the other exercises. But the Venom was not my aircraft and it wasn't doing the work that I enjoyed doing.
Was it a requirement at that time then for a night fighter for the fleet?
Oh yes, that's what the Venom was for. And any carrier would have a Seahawk squadron. The light fleet carriers like the Albion and Bulwark and Ocean would have a Seahawk squadron, a Venom squadron, perhaps and probably an airborne early warning aircraft, maybe two, and a helicopter. And that was the makeup of the ship. But I don't think the night fighting tactics that we had would ever have served any purpose. They were never used in war.
I was going to say, how much of a threat would it have been perceived to be, really? Because I know in the Second World War there was an attempt to get night fighters organised for the fleets in the Mediterranean, but it didn't seem that there was ever really a threat to a fleet at night.
No, well, of course, at that time, the airborne radar was very, very primitive, and they would be quite lucky if they could get into the vicinity of a ship, never mind attack it. Our airborne radar in Barracudas at the end of the war was so primitive that if there was any sort of a sea state, I mean sea state 4 and higher, you couldn't see anything because the whole screen was covered in white from the reflections from the waves. So it took a long time for the radar to develop until in aircraft like the Sea Vixen later. That was very much better in picking out the targets, and what it could do was to pick out a moving target. And that, of course, was the object of the exercise. If it was moving, it was a target. But the Venoms weren't as good as that, and our weapons weren't as good as that, and the aircraft wasn't as good as that. So one way or another, it was a bit of a dead loss, I would say.
Did it have any other armament apart from the guided missiles?
Don't think so. Can't remember. It had an enormous radar dome in the front, so there was no cannon or guns firing out of the fuselage, and I can't remember any in the wings. Do you know, isn't it terrible? I can't remember. I don't think so.
So you said you were unhappy, obviously, in the posting.
Well, I enjoyed it when the Seahawks were there, because it was the sort of flying that I enjoyed. But again, you see, I couldn't carry out my favourite pastime, which was formation aerobatics. The Venom could be aerobatted, but it wasn't a nice aircraft to aerobat. And in formation, it didn't look good. So when they decided to change, I was very disappointed. And the other thing I got into quite severe trouble with was... I had difficulty getting the right number of Venoms into the air to give the student pilots the amount of flying that they should be having. And, for example, if I wanted to start the day with four aircraft taking off at 8 o'clock and one spare, sometimes I had a difficulty in getting it. And I couldn't understand why, because with the Seahawks, we had been able to produce as many aircraft first thing in the morning as I needed. So we're discussing this with the AEO, trying to find out why there was so much difficulty. And he said, well, the fact is that when we do these minor inspections, they seem to take far longer than they ever used to take in the front line or at Yeovilton, where the Venoms were normally based. So we puzzled about this for a while, and the Admiral sent up one of his engineers to go over this with us and find out why we had this problem. So he came up, and then he started to look through the ratings service documents. And it was interesting to see that their experience on Venoms was either zero, or they had come to the squadron from a holding station or a repair station. None of them had been in a frontline Venom squadron. So as far as they were concerned, an aircraft was there to be worked on. It wasn't there to fly. And they didn't have the incentive to get the aircraft back in the air, and we hadn't appreciated this. So I began to look at the situation again a bit more closely. And I spoke to the drafting officer about this. And he said, well, that's very simple. When our squadron is coming back from sea, from a frontline tour, and the men are all absolutely on top notch, they're asked where they'd like to go. And we give them two choices. So if they were trained at Yeovilton, and that's where their married quarters are, their first choice is to go back to Yeovilton. And their second choice is to go to an air station within striking distance of Yeovilton. And that's not Lossiemouth. So we started to look at this again, and there we were. Every experienced Venom rating, maintenance rating, was going elsewhere. So we made this point to the Admiral. More tooth-sucking. And once again, I wasn't popular because I had pointed out something that his staff ought to have recognised beforehand. But it's an interesting point that they had made this decision to move the Seahawks away from Lossie when they'd been there for years. And the Seahawk ratings were quite keen to go back to Lossiemouth. So there we were, in an absolutely ridiculous situation.